Why Can't I Stop? A Glimpse into Addiction. If there was one thing that I feared more than anything else, it was becoming an addict. It didn't matter what the addiction may have been, the negative connotations drilled into me were way too powerful to ignore. That is, until a chance meeting at a lecture led me to my first encounter with a recovering addict who was not just going through the motions, but had unexpectedly discovered a rich, meaningful vision of life. Now I will tell you how I ended up almost wishing to be an addict. Why Can't I Stop? A Glimpse into Addiction is a four-part documentary that examines the causes, consequences, and perceptions of addiction as relayed by a handful of recovering alcoholics, counselors, educators, and the kids in my neighborhood. In Part 1, the focus is on the evolution of the concept of addiction. Part 2 is the anatomy of an addiction. In Part 3, I look at the process of recovery, and in Part 4, life after addiction. And now for Part 3. Recovery. Restoration from sickness, weakness, faintness, or the like. Restoration from a condition of misfortune or fright. A return to a normal condition. I suppose what matters most is what one is returning to and mapping the road back. This is probably the most controversial aspect of addiction. There are numerous recovery methods, each with its positives and negatives. No matter what the approach, it is clear that for it to be successful, one has to want to recover at all costs, and that can be only done when the problem is recognized. Stephanie, a recovering alcoholic, talks about that flash of recognition.
I always felt inferior to the people around me and even my classmates until, you know, we'd be drinking together and then Fun Steph would come out because I thought that the only person that people wanted to see was Fun Steph. I'd created this persona that these are the three or four characteristics that people want to see or that people will like, and then the rest of Steph people won't like. So I only ever presented those three or four characteristics. And that's a hard bill to fill, you know, constantly all the time. You know, in friendships or acquaintance or having acquaintances, you can hold up that persona for a long time. But in intimate relationships, it's really, really hard to hold up that persona for more than a couple of weeks. Because I thought that people only wanted to see a strong, independent woman who was funny. And, you know, I've heard this was common for a lot of people with addiction problems, is that, you know, pain was my worst enemy and so was vulnerability, my worst enemy. So feeling both of those things, because those pain and vulnerability totally, you know, reinforced the fact that I was a scared little girl who nobody wanted to be around, because why else would I feel that way? So it was going okay for a while, and then I started to get more friends, and as a classic alcoholic that I have severe swings between scared little girl and massive ego. And so as I began to get more friends and began to get respect of those people around me, my ego began to balloon and I began to drink and use more and more and more, and until I found myself into another full-blown binge. I've had two in my life, and they're both pretty much the scariest things I've ever encountered, because it's difficult to go to school and have people say nice things about you when what I've done in the morning is woken up with severe feelings of guilt and remorse and sadness and having to carry that all around with me and never being able to share that or show that to anybody, even though other people could see it, but nobody ever told me about it or nobody ever shared that those feelings were okay to have. Being in a binge, having that feeling day after day after day, those awful feelings, they build up after a while, and so I had to try harder and harder and harder to to maintain that outside crust of my life so that maybe people wouldn't see what was going on inside. At some point, I got depressed, I got exhausted, I got burnt out, and I was also in a full-blown binge. So what I found was that in the year before I got sober, the thing that I noticed most was that my outsides started to look like my insides. I couldn't maintain that outer persona anymore. It was starting to crumble piece by piece by piece, and like the harder I tried to pull it together, the less I was able to. I felt like this ball of elastics that a kid collects, and like one by one the elastics were snapping and there was nothing I could do about it. About 6 or 8 months before I got sober, and then for the following 6 or 8 months I spent trying to figure out how I was going to get sober, how I was going to deal with life. And the last 4 or 5 months were torturous. I thought I was slowly losing all ability to control any of my emotions. And at that point, feeling anything other than euphoric was unacceptable and was absolute pain for me. My depression got worse. My mood swings were absolutely unbearable. I stopped being able to work, which led to more guilt and remorse because I was still going to work. And I stopped being able to work. My depression got so severe, and I didn't really, really know what the problem was. I knew I had to quit drinking. I didn't think that was the problem. I thought that there was more than that, but all I knew was that there was a severe problem, and that if I didn't do something about my life, I would have to be institutionalized at some point soon, because I was feeling on the edge of something, and I don't know what it was, but the only thing that I could describe it as is an abyss. And so I decided one day, after a full day of crying, to quit my job, to quit all of my extracurricular activities, and 3 weeks later got sober.
Recovering addicts Doug, Jean, Rick, and Blake also identify their turning points.
For me, the recognition that I said after that meal, and I recognized that I had a problem with alcohol for the first time, and I started to call myself an alcoholic. But I didn't see it as a problem, because alcohol to me was a friend, and it enabled me to do things that I could not do without it. The addiction part, while it was there, in my mind anyway, there are good and bad addictions. We can all be addicted to too much cleanliness, too much, you know, there are things in our lives that we are all addicted to. But when it comes to alcoholism, the addiction, because of the progression of it, it leads only to two places, either to insanity or to death. And it's a proven fact that those are the only two ends that we have if we continue to use. So for me, the recognition of it being an addiction didn't bother me at all. It had to progressively get worse until I did have mental problems. That was when I had to start to surrender, which took quite a while.
All I knew in myself was that I had reached a stage where I didn't feel comfortable at all in life without a drink. And then, of course, I had the periods of discomfort when I couldn't remember what I did or I did serious things. And I knew that alcohol could lead you down a path, as Doug said, to either death or insanity. And I could see myself going that way. As I said, I wasn't prepared to take my own life, but life wasn't worth living the way I was living. And I had a lot of fear for my children, for their safety. And I never really thought of the word, you know, addiction. I didn't like saying I was an alcoholic in the beginning, because I wasn't really sure I was going to be very comfortable in life without a drink, but I knew it was a necessity. I knew that alcohol was no longer a friend, and if I was to have any kind of a life, it had to not involve alcohol. And since I could not stop on my own, and I had tried many times to stop on my own, and I didn't have any success. And maybe in the beginning I'd have a couple of months, and then I might have a month, and then I might have a week, and it just got to the stage that there was no period of time in there that I could go without a drink. So I knew it, quote, I used to say, was a problem.
One point that I was thinking of was that although I knew I was in deep trouble all my life, the way I saw it was that I drank because of my problem. And a key turning point was understanding that I had problems, because I drank. I mean, although I recognized it all the way along, I always thought, well, I have all these troubles, so I'll alleviate the pain, not understanding that alleviating the pain was the cause of most of the problems.
When I was drinking, I subscribed to the four necessities of life, which are food, shelter, and clothing, and someone to blame. I decided that my wife, primarily, was responsible for most part for my predicament because she didn't recognize a great guy like me who should really be at university instead of working out in the with a blue collar on. And she already had two jobs at one time to support my drinking. But if I got away from her, I'd straighten out and do okay. And so I proceeded to do that. And I quickly discovered that nothing had changed, that I was still the same screwed up person. I remember seeing a psychiatrist, and I remember vaguely saying to him, "Do you think I'm a psychopath?" Because I had already taken some, I think I'd taken Psychology 100 up here, you see. And he said, "Well, I don't know." And I was hoping that I would be a psychopath, because that would allow me to continue drinking.
Many addicts know they have a problem, but don't make the leap from knowledge to action. Drug and alcohol counseling educators Bill Peacock and Joe Ellis explain.
It's funny, one of the things that it's when you're in what I call in the circle, you're unaware. But for those who aren't in the circle, it's obvious when you're looking at it. It's like watching a game. Watching the game is not the same as playing the game. And many times we call it the Saturday morning quarterbacks, making decisions behind the glass, whatever it may be, in relation to a sports game. And it's real easy to see from the stands what's going on. Well, if they only, and you fill in the blank, if they only made that shot, if they only moved that defenseman there, if they only whatever. But when you're playing the game and you're the player in the game, you're unaware sometimes of what you're doing. And I think many times people are totally unaware the impact and effect that's what's going on. They just get into that downward spiral.
Yeah, exactly. The downward spiral takes over. And so what happens when they're caught in this downward spiral is they drink. And the irony, of course, is most people think that they're feeling happier when they're drinking when it's a depressant, right? So and the other thing that's going on is their tolerance to alcohol is increasing. So now it takes more for me to get to a euphoric place, and the dysphoria where I'm feeling like crap gets greater. So now my tolerance is going up, which means it takes more for me to get to that happy place, euphoric. My dysphoria is getting greater, which means I'm feeling more like crap when I'm not in the place of use. And so then it starts getting into this really crazy place where for some it seems like then they want to get out of the addiction, but they're trapped. And it really seems like suicide's the only way out.
And depending upon the substance of choice, there are some substances that have reactions that are so totally different. I'm thinking now of people with heroin addiction and people with crack cocaine addiction, even cocaine dependencies, because of the nature of the substance, the chemistry of the substance does a really weird number. It's terribly scientific, isn't it? Does a really weird number on people's heads. And the thinking process gets totally crazy. Totally crazy, let alone the emotive piece. Right. And again, they don't understand. I mean, you hear stories of people who you say, how could you do that to yourself? How could you snort so much cocaine that you had Kleenex up your nose all day, you know, and you're bleeding and that kind of thing. And then you do bizarre things to get the money to do the things. And the addict, the cocaine addict says at the time, no, I just want that rush, even though they're not getting the rush.
Right.
But that craving control of something else over them just takes over. And then in recovery, they'll look back on that and say, I didn't understand that. And they didn't at the time. They're in the game. They didn't understand what was going on.
Abstinence and harm reduction are major recovery models. Bill Peacock and Joe Ellis discuss when each one is appropriate.
And all that is done on an abstinence-based model. So the interaction between the substance and the person is not happening. So it's abstinence-based. It's not a moderation model that says let's reduce the amount that the person is using. Let's not use. And then when we don't use and not use, then we work through all these other pieces, which really, in some ways, are ways of living that have a lot of strength, I think, in just our interactions with people day to day. Moderation management will look at things a little bit differently. And they would predicate their model a little bit differently than the disease model, because they're saying, well, we can reduce use, so that's not a problematic level. And there are some people that works for them as well. So the interaction between the substance and the biology is a little bit different, perhaps.
Where do you fall in on the whole abstinence moderation picture?
Oh, what works for the individual is what works for the individual. I'm very much eclectic in that kind of view. As a therapist, as a helper, that's where I'm at. I'm with my client. Whatever I can do to assist, facilitate, support, value the person such that their life is going to a place that they want it to go to, that is enriching for them, then whatever model works, let's go with it. And that's tough. Because there are people sometimes that you know in the long term that the abstinence-based model is the best and you know will probably work best for them, but they're not ready for it yet. They're not quite there yet. So perhaps initially I'd use maybe a motivational interviewing approach and that kind of thing to get them to realize and make some decisions later on. Because if I work through a challenge on their denial, then perhaps what I'm going to get is resistance. And one model would say, well, we've got to break through that resistance and we've got to break down that person's resistance. Well, that may work, but if it's been tried 2 or 3 times and the person's resistance just keeps increasing, I've got to come at it some other way.
One of the things I want is my clients to stay alive, right? So if I'm dealing with an IV drug user, intravenous drug user, and some people will think this is real crazy, but one of the first things I want them to do is not use needles. And what they'll tell me is they still want that same high. So if I can get them to inject their substance into a cigarette and smoke it, we may have just saved their lives, which sounds crazy, right? Because harm reduction, we've reduced all kinds of harm in terms of Hep C, AIDS. Yet in terms of the addiction piece, we may not have reduced it. Part of the huge problem is you can't make someone do what they're not prepared to do. We were chatting last night about, I can't remember, was it Father Martin that had that?
Father Martin, yeah.
Saying is, you can drag a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And the add-on is, yeah, but I can make it pretty thirsty, right? So it's like you can try and surround people with the appropriate supports. I think what we're seeing and will continue to see is more and more home detox. So you're right. There's going to be less bucks out there to work things, which coming back to the education piece, we have to get smarter within our communities. We have to grow in our level of acceptance. Many people can, in fact, detoxify at home. What does that mean? It means the people who are doing the detoxifying need to be trained. Because they may have been the codependent people up to that point, and suddenly they're taking a major role in assisting members of their friends or family in the initial process of recovery. So even if I may not, as a therapist, 100% believe in the AA model, what I do believe in is the peer support model, and AA provides that. So what I'm trying to do is individual counseling, help the person detoxify, get them out into a model where they see that there are other people like them who have survived. Maybe I'm starting to get them active in groups, psychotherapeutic groups. And then we do work on cognitive behavioral changes, whether it's individual or in a group setting.
The most well-known abstinence-based approach is the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has surged in popularity since its beginning in the 1930s and has led to many offshoots such as Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, and Gamblers Anonymous. But because of the insidious nature of addiction, it takes a brutally honest self-assessment to determine where the road to recovery lies. AA's 12-step program is more than a recovery model. It becomes a way of life. Many other recovery organizations incorporate AA principles. Stephanie participated in a feminist recovery program in addition to AA. She talks about her new way of life.
I went to treatment and I started going to AA, and I thought that when I came in I was just going to get sober. I wasn't even planning on quitting using drugs. I just wanted to quit drinking. And in order to be in a couple of different programs, I had to have complete abstinence. So I thought that it was worth it because I couldn't handle alcohol in my life at all anymore. And I thought I would just get sober, and it's been so much more than that, because once I took alcohol into my life, you know, it's been a temporary relief to that. All of my problems are still there. That scared little girl deep down inside is still there. And so not only does my recovery mean that I have to develop techniques and habits and tools not to drink, but it's tools for living now, because I not only have to stop drinking, I also have to figure out how to be the person I really want to be. So it's been about so much more than getting sober. It's been about learning how to live as the person I am, not the person that I 16 years ago decided I was and stopped emotionally developing at that point. So I've learned so much, you know, like I'm starting to learn how to talk to people about how I actually feel, and talking to people about, like, I could never say before that, you know, I'm just this scared little girl. I could never say those kinds of things before. I'm learning how to make friends that don't use. I'm still not entirely sure how to do that, but I'm starting to learn how to do that. I'm learning that discipline's not a bad thing in my life. I'm learning that, you know what, maybe I don't know what the fuck is going on. And maybe I do need to just sit down and listen to what somebody else has to say.
Unfortunately, recovery is not as easy as completing a 28-day program and then resuming your daily routine. Joe Ellis and Bill Peacock talk about some of the challenges.
We're a quick-fix society, and the prescription drug piece is like that. You go to a physician, perhaps, or you go to a counselor, perhaps, and the things that we've been talking about are time involvement, investment in time. It's reflective practice. It's getting people to think and understand and work through and grow. And that takes some time. But it's like, what can you do for me next Tuesday? And if I can get there by next Tuesday, then great. I'm looking at the short term. And I don't know how to get out of that, but I think that's where we're headed. And I think our Canadian society is less so than perhaps American societies and perhaps some Asian societies as well, because the pace of things is so much quicker. So we expect things to happen very, very quickly. And we know when we talk about recovery, and we know we talk about growth, and we know we talk about it takes people time to get into substance misuse. It takes people time to get out of it as well. And both of those is time. Alcohol in particular, it takes a while to get there. You know, and with other drugs as well, it takes a while to get there. So to expect to get out
instant
of it.
Instant recovery, yeah.
It's not going to happen. It's not instant coffee kind of thing. So that's a societal piece as well that I'm seeing that's different now than what it was, say, 10 years ago.
And I think another piece that's really hard for people is changing their personal environment. So if all my buddies drink, for a whole slew of reasons, because I've surrounded myself with bunch of buddies who drink, and I go to Joe as my counselor, and Joe says, well, Bill, you got to stop drinking. And I'm going like, so who would I hang out with? Because nobody I know doesn't drink, right? And so looking at those kind of transitions, or drugging or whatever, or both or whatever. So looking at trying to make those changes can be really horrific. And if it's in the family, right, so everybody in my family drinks and drugs, what, I'm supposed to go buy myself a new family? And so some of the choices are really, really tough. And that period of recovery can be deeply undermined by friends and family who don't want you to suddenly feel like, they start feeling like if you're sitting there having a ginger ale, that somehow you're judging them. And even if you only say, I'm just doing this for me. You do what you need to do. I'm working on my own recovery. They still feel that somehow there's been a breach, that you no longer are as trustworthy because you're no longer, quote, one of us.
And that's where that crazy thinking goes into place, because then you could sort of beat up yourself by sort of saying, yeah, maybe there's something wrong with me. And you go down that path.
Yeah.
And if it's an alcohol issue, it's well, yeah, I'll just ingrain myself in that, right? And then it's just that crazy thinking piece again that just doesn't make sense. If you don't have a good self-image, you don't feel good about your choice, you don't feel like, well, this is okay for me, and that's your stuff. I mean, if you don't like veggies, and that's your stuff. I'm cool. But that's a different response, and the person's at a different headspace than somebody saying, well, gee, am I making the right choice here? They don't really like it. Do I need approval from them in order for me to be happy?
What it all comes down to is finding a compelling reason to be sober and finding the help to develop the tools to cope with life after abuse. Nurse educator Helen Henry has the final word.
I think, you know, the people that we see, there's always that spark of motivation. Whether it's come originally from, you know, a push from somebody else or whether it's coming from within them, there has to be some motivation because they're going through quite a bit here in terms of going through withdrawal, in terms of, in treatment, looking in minute detail at their lives, the impact that substance use has had on their lives, learning new ways of coping, opening up, communicating, sharing, often things that are very painful to share. And so they need that spark of motivation and that desire to be better people. You know, once they're detoxed and so on, I think what we see is everybody wants a better life, everybody wants to make a contribution to have some meaning to their lives.
And one of the things you do here is teach coping methods.
Yes, in fact, that's the main thrust of our programs. Once people are detoxified, is to look at what areas of their life have been affected. And so they learn things like communication skills, recreational skills, how to support someone, how to be supported, how to be aware of your needs, how do you get them met, how do you feel good about yourself, what do you do in your spare time. What do you do when you're feeling stressed? What do you do if you feel lonely or bored or you've got a craving? Or, you know, what do you do when somebody approaches you and offers you something? So we use things like, you know, role-playing, group support. Cognitive behavioral strategies are very important in our treatment program. Looking at what you think and how that affects your behavior and how you feel. Okay? So if I feel that I'm always a failure, I'm not going to amount to anything, there's no point in even trying, then I feel discouraged, and I'm not likely to try. Whereas if I think that, basically I'm okay, maybe I just haven't found the right path until now, but, you know, I can do it with support, with encouragement, I feel more optimistic, and then my behavior will reflect that as well. So we look at, you know, cognitive behavioral strategies, what's my self-talk? What am I saying? What are my beliefs? Are they valid?
This concludes part 3 of Why Can't I Stop? A Glimpse into Addiction. Tune in tomorrow at 8:30 a.m. as the addict ponders life after abuse and the vice ponders life after the documentary. For more info, please email liberationckcu@canada.com.